Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where I shall be carrying on my narrative all about the decline and fall of the Roman Republic. So this episode, I'm going to talk about Marius, Gaius Marius. Didn't have a third name, Plutarch tells us, so it's just Gaius Marius, which gives away, straight off the bat, that he wasn't noble. When I talked about the Gracchi brothers, they are very aristocratic, and nearly everyone involved in high politics in Rome, in this generation and for many generations to come, will sort of have to be blue-blooded or aristocratic or well-to-do. Their family steeped in honours and history. But Gaius Marius wasn't. But I've had to think very carefully about how to tell this story, because in the next episode, I wanted to talk all about the career of Sulla, Lucius Cornelius Sulla. Now, Sulla's 20 years younger than Marius, but their stories are heavily, heavily entwined. And so it's sort of difficult, a bit difficult, to separate the two narratives. So what I think I'll do is a two or three or perhaps even four-part series about Marius and Sulla. And for this first episode, I'll be concentrating mostly, almost entirely, on Marius and mentioning Sulla when he comes up. And then next episode, I'll talk more about the early career of Sulla, and then we can take the narrative forward when their lives and careers fully collide and intertwine. So once again, I'll be reading exclusively from Plutarch. We do get a bit more in Appian. We begin to get a bit more detail in Appian, but more in episodes 2 and 3 of this series. Still not a great deal, or not really anything, on the early life of Marius in Appian. So let's dive straight in. Plutarch tells us a bit about the early life of Marius, and as I said, he came from almost nothing, not complete penury. They weren't utter peasants, living in squalor and nearly starving to death, but not much above that, really. His family were clients of the Metelli, the family of Metellus. Now, at this point, Metellus is one of the most important politicians, statesmen in Rome. Him and Scipio Africanus the Younger, that is, Scipio Aemilianus, they're probably the two most prominent, most eminent politicians in Rome. So to have Metellus as your patron, that's not nothing. That could easily translate, and does in the case of Marius, that could easily translate into getting a leg up in life. But Marius always kept, throughout his entire life, his entire career, he kept that connection with the people. He was a man of the people, and it wasn't an affectation. He really was. He really came from sort of nothing. So we're told over and over again that he wasn't particularly eloquent. He hadn't been trained in oratory. He wasn't a polished rhetorician. He didn't have a great education. He didn't really care about Greek things. That was an indication of a Roman's education at this point. Were you familiar with Greek culture? Did you have any Greek? Could you speak Greek? Could you read and speak Greek? Do you know all about their myths and legends? Did you go to the theatre and watch Greek plays? Because your average Roman citizen, your average Roman urban pleb, certainly wouldn't. In fact, they would think there was something effeminate or very specifically un-Roman about Greekness. Only effeminate, highfalutin patricians do that sort of thing. A good, honest, solid, salt-of-the-earth Roman doesn't read Greek, doesn't go to Greek plays. And that's what Marius was like. We're told that he thought it was, quote, ridiculous to study a literature the teachers of which were subject to others, end quote. Because, of course, the Romans had already conquered Greece by this point. So a quick paragraph from Plutarch on Marius' early life. We're told, quote, his parents, Marius and Fulcina, were entirely undistinguished. They were poor people who lived by the labour of their own hands. For a long time, he never saw Rome or got any taste of city life. During this period, he lived in the village of Curhaeton, near Arpinum, in a style rough and unrefined, if compared with the polished ways of cities, but temperate in accordance with the ancient Roman standards of education. His first military service was against the Celtibrians at the time when Scipio Africanus was besieging Numantia, so that is in Spain. He attracted the general's attention by showing a bravery which was outstanding among the rest of the recruits, and by the cheerful way in which he accepted and changed regime which Scipio was imposing on an army corrupted by luxury and extravagance. So he was a very good soldier, straight off the bat. He is also said to have fought single-handed with one of the enemy and to have struck him down in sight of the general. That's a great honour to have done that. There's few greater things you could do in Roman society, because other accounts say it wasn't just an enemy, it was actually an enemy leader. So the greatest things in all of Roman society you could achieve was, one, the consulship, which is like being a prime minister or a president or something. So that's very, very high political office. That's the pinnacle. That's what everyone was aiming at. The second greatest thing of three that you could possibly achieve is a military triumph, i.e. being the leader of an army. Probably need to be a consul or a proconsul before you ever got that command in the first place. Then winning a great victory where the city of Rome has a parade in your honour, a triumph. So becoming a consul, being awarded a triumph. And the third greatest thing is to kill an enemy leader in sight of your general in single combat. Now that's something a bit different, isn't it? That's not like high political office or having a parade in your honour. That's more like winning a Victoria Cross or a Congressional Medal of Honour. It's something a bit different. And it's super, super rare. I mean, there's only a handful of guys in all of Republican Roman history that ever did it. It's even rarer than a Victoria Cross or a Congressional Medal of Honour. But what it does say is that there's just no doubt that you personally are extremely brave and extremely good at fighting. You would be famous for doing that, absolutely. Plutarch goes on that as a result of winning that single combat, as a result, Scipio conferred many marks of distinction on him. There was one occasion when during a conversation after dinner, the talk turned on generals, and one of those present, either because he really wanted to know or merely out of flattery, said to Scipio, "What commander and what leader can the Roman people possibly find to be a worthy successor to you?" Scipio then gently tapped Marius on the shoulder as he reclined next to him and said, "Perhaps this is the man." Now there's another thing as old as time, patronage. You know, if someone extremely famous as Scipio was, held in extremely high regard, if he sort of personally singles you out, quite literally physically taps you on the shoulder and said, "You're as good as me. In the next generation, if you play your cards right, if you're lucky, you could be as good as me." In ancient Republican Roman history, in fact, much more than today even, that counts for a great deal. Everyone noticed that and saw that and remembered that. And in fact, Plutarch even tells us that that massively inflated Marius's own concept of himself. That from that point onward, he started to believe that he was capable of almost anything. That where he came from very, very poor and humble beginnings, that now Scipio had singled him out and he'd undeniably done extremely well in war, that perhaps, perhaps maybe I could have a political career back in Rome. Perhaps the sky is the limit. You know, I might not dream of consulships yet, but, you know, maybe I could go back to Rome. I've earned a name for myself. Maybe I could, you know, run to be a tribune of the people or something. Well, so that's exactly what he does. He does return to Rome and he's sort of got a name. He's got name recognition in Rome. He's still young, very young still. And his patron also was Metellus, as I mentioned. So he asked Metellus, you know, "Will you help me out? Will you back me up if I run for tribune of the people? Obviously, I'll have your back, Metellus, if and when I win office." Metellus says yes. You know, there's this bright young thing as one of his clients. You know, he might be a great tool further down the line. Metellus would want at least one of the tribunes to be his man. So he says yes. And Marius only goes ahead and wins and becomes a tribune. But what he does, pretty much straight away, I mean literally straight away, doesn't really play the game that the Roman state and the Senate and Metellus would want him to do. He starts doing the sorts of things that the Gracchi had done. Are you just being a thorn in the side of the patrician class and the landed ruling aristocracy? Because remember, he's a man of the people. He would be a popularis. In fact, I'll actually just start talking about the popularis and the optimate factions. Marius, of course. And so what he does kind of straight away when becoming tribune, urban tribune, is introduce a law which kind of reforms the way voting was done, and the way voting was done, particularly in the popular assembly, was quite complicated and convoluted and sort of unnecessarily difficult, and it was open to all sorts of gerrymandering and ways to tweak and trick the system, nearly always in the favour of the Senate. And so Marius brings in reforms to make that a lot fairer. And so the consul for that year, a guy called Cotta, i.e. the leader of the Senate, one of the consuls, Cotta, says, you know, you can't do that. We're going to strike that down. You know, we've seen people like Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus. If we see troublesome tribunes, we're basically going to suppress them straight away before they get out of hand, before they become a darling of the people and form a big faction around themselves. We don't want to go down that avenue anymore. So Cotta just says, no, Marius, who do you think you are, you upstart? No, we're just not going to let you do that. No. And Cotta brings Marius up on charges straight away and insists that he comes before the Senate and answer for himself. So basically this Cotta is going to give Marius a dressing down, a ticking off. You know, who do you think you are, boy? But when Marius goes before the Senate, where he's going to be rebuked for overstepping the mark straight away, he just doubles down. He's fearless. He's got a fire in his belly. You know, a young man who's got something to prove and not much to lose. He just threatens Cotta. He threatens the consul. We're told he threatened to drag Cotta off to prison. He says, you know, I don't care about the Senate. I don't care about that you're the consul. I'm a tribune of the people. The letter of the law is I can propose laws before the assembly. And you're going to make me answer for myself. No. You need to answer for yourself. How dare you try to impeach me or dress me down or whatever you think you're doing? How dare you? No, if you try and stop me from doing this, I'm going to take you to prison. How about that? And of course, there's a much kerfuffle in the Senate at this. And the consul Cotta turns to Metellus and says, you know, what is your boy doing? You know, Metellus, one of the most powerful men in Rome, with sort of almost unlimited authority and gravitas. Cotta says, Metellus, look, you know, get your lad in order. And you're on my side, right? You've got my back on this, right? And Metellus says, yeah, of course, I'm with you, Cotta. I'm with the Senate. Marius has gone too far here. I'm sorry, I'm a bit embarrassed. And Metellus openly says this, sort of in open debate. He sides with Cotta and says to Marius, you know, calm down. You know, what do you think you're doing? And Marius just says to his patron, Metellus, the guy that he owes everything to, really. He wouldn't be a tribune if it wasn't for him. He says, I'll put you in prison as well then. How about that? And of course, you can only imagine Metellus is aghast. But Marius really means it. He starts calling for men, for lictors, to come and drag Marius off. And so in that moment, the Senate blinks. We're told, just completely explicitly by Plutarch, that the Senate gave in and rescinded its previous vote, i.e. its vote to, you know, get rid of Marius as a tribune. So the Senate very rarely sort of loses, if you like, or blinks, but it does in this moment, in the face of Marius doubling down and then redoubling down, the people, the Popularis faction, and the very young, the very green Gaius Marius get a win. And we're told that he's sort of cheered through the streets, and it was a great sort of personal and political triumph for him. And he gets his law ratified to sort of, you know, change the voting system a bit. And so, straight away, he is not just kind of a darling of the Popularis faction, but, you know, one of their leaders straight away. Not necessarily their preeminent, undisputed leader, but among their leaders. So he's carved out a political position for himself very quickly indeed. One other thing quickly to mention is later in that same year, his same term as tribune, a law comes up to make the grain dole a bit cheaper. Sorry, it's not the grain dole. At this point, Rome, I mentioned that Gaius Gracchus brought it in. The Roman state buys up massive supplies of grain and sells it at a massive discount to the starving urban plebs to keep them quiet and to make sure they don't just starve. And there was a law proposed to make it even cheaper. And Marius sort of prevents that from happening. Now that, of course, would be very unpopular with the people. But we're told the fickle nature of the Roman collective political mind is that he went up in everyone's estimation for doing that, because it showed that he wasn't just a complete partisan for the people. Yeah, we're told that he was equally respected by both parties, i.e. that he was a man that had his own mind and his own political ideas, and although he would, you can bet on, that he would usually always side with popular measures, be on the side of the people. Not necessarily always. So interesting. Next for Marius's career, because, you know, being a tribune only lasts 1 year, he tries to run to be an aedile. And the role of the aedile, there's two types of aediles, and they're sort of more sort of administrative roles, politically, specifically politically, administrative roles. And they're quite prestigious. Well, very prestigious, really. And it's a bit of a jump up for a young man who's, although he's got a very stellar military career, and he's been tribune, it's still a bit of a step up. You'd usually want older men to be an aedile, people that knew the system inside out, people that could be trusted, you know, that the state could trust. You know, you don't necessarily get on an extremely important military or intelligence committee today in Britain or America, unless you're a bit older and that you've shown that you can keep secrets and you won't leak and that sort of thing. I always get the impression that being an aedile is that sort of thing. So it wasn't really the best idea for the young Gaius Marius, who wouldn't have been trusted by the establishment, if you like. He's a popularis man. He stabbed his own benefactor, Metellus, in the back straight away, politically. He can't necessarily be trusted. So he actually loses that election to become an aedile. In fact, as I mentioned, there's two different types of aedile, a more senior and a more junior version. And he's running for the more senior version. And halfway through the votes being collected, he realises he's not going to win. So he quickly changes over to stand for the more inferior one, hoping that he could at least win that. But he lost that as well. And Plutarch says that he was in the unprecedented position of having lost two elections in one day, which is quite funny. But very soon after that, he runs for office as a praetor. Now that's interesting, because praetors are sort of just below the consul. To be a praetor is a very, very high office, much higher than an aedile. On the cursus honorum, it is one, really, sort of one below the consul. And as a propraetor, in other words, after you've finished your praetorship, as a propraetor, you're usually, or nearly always, given a governorship or an extremely senior military command. So to go from being a tribune of the people one time, failing to get elected as an aedile, you've got to give him credit for having sort of the balls to even think he could run for praetor and win. But he does, and does. He won. Apparently he was prosecuted for bribery, though. He basically bought his praetorship. And I won't go into the detail because it's not that interesting, but Plutarch tells us, goes into a fair bit of detail about how the prosecution against him for all the bribery involved in his run for office as a praetor, and all sorts of loopholes were exploited so that witnesses couldn't testify against him. And he just gets away with it by the skin of his teeth. Apparently he only won the election in an extremely narrow vote, and it was a corrupt vote anyway. So, but there you go. That's the way it worked in Rome quite often in this period. If you could get away with it, and then if you could avoid prosecution, that's sort of the end of the story. And so Marius does do exactly that. And we're told that in his trial, the jurors came back and their decision on whether he should be found innocent or guilty were exactly equal. And so in the Roman system of law at that point, if that was the case, it meant you were acquitted. They erred on the side of you being innocent. So it was the closest possible margin to his entire political career just coming to a crashing end right there and then. But it didn't, and he got away with it. And so onwards and upwards for Gaius Marius. And we're told, Plutarch says that, quote, his praetorship was not particularly distinguished. Just not a great deal, not anything really of note happened during his year as praetor. But when he'd finished that, the next year as propraetor, he was, as was usual, given a governorship, and he was sent to Hispania Ulterior. And I'll put a map up so you can see exactly where that is. Where we're told he put down banditry, because again, he's a military man first and foremost. That was where he made his name in the first place. And he is extremely brave. He just is a good soldier. There's no doubt about that. This is the thing that comes up in Marius's career again and again and again and again. He's a great soldier, both personally on the ground, fighting, being amongst the ranks, doing stuff, and as a general, as a tactician and a strategist. He's great. He's a military man. As a politician, he's not great. He gets through by the skin of his teeth again and again and again, or fails. He has all sorts of political reverses. So he's good at military things and bad at political things, basically. So in his governorship in Spain, he puts down all sorts of banditry, which everyone loves, other than the bandits themselves.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.